Welcome, everyone. It's good to be with you again. My name is Michael Coffey, and my good friend Mark Washington and I are going to continue our presentation on interracial fellowship and congregations. How many of you were here for the first session on Monday? And so a few of you were not, is that right? So we're going to do some recap in a minute and then go right into today's session. It is really, really a great feeling this week as what we're doing, what Anna's doing, what Glenn's doing, all feel like they're complementing one another, and we hope that what we do today will continue that. But if you haven't been going to Anna's sessions, I think they're really, really important, and they are helping. There's content there that we're going to not do because we don't have time, and she's doing a deeper work on that. So please be a part of that as well. So just to give you an overview of what we're doing, on Monday we did our Telling Our Story, The Great Racial Divide, Charleston, and Intentionality. Today we're doing White People's Work, Speaking the Truth in Love. If you didn't know you showed up for the hard day, well, don't leave. This is the hard day. Friday, Building Up the Body in Love. We're going to open with a prayer.
Let's do that. Let's pray. God, we thank you for this time together, this time of reflection, this time of reconciliation, and this time of renewal. Now be with us, not only in our speaking, but our hearing, and even in the moments after this session. We thank you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Okay, so to recap, we began our journey right after the mass shooting that happened at Mother Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. I received the, after some community meetings, we received an email from Michael and his congregations wanting to continue our dialogue around the issues of racial reconciliation. And we had several churches engaged citywide, but there were people who responded in the moment, but there was a more sustaining conversation that Michael and I continued among our congregations, and we began to fellowship with each other at each other's churches, with the leaders in our congregation. Some of it was related to programming that was already in place, and others were times it was very intentional things that we were trying to do to bring each other together, particularly our men's retreat that we planned over a weekend at one of the Lutheran camps. There were very, very deep spiritual connections, as well as fellowship among the different congregations. Next slide.
Okay, so the text that we're using to guide us in thinking about all this is from Ephesians 4, and we're going to just listen to the text again now. And then a little bit later, we're going to dive in deeper to it. And as we read it, I'll just point out that the highlight sections in blue are sort of the 3 days of what we're doing. Who would read the first paragraph for us out loud, and who would read the second paragraph for us out loud? Paragraph one, paragraph two, I saw first back there. Please.
I, therefore, the prisoner in the Lord, beg you to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, making every effort to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to the one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in all.
But each of us was given grace according to the measure of Christ's gift. The gifts he gave were that some would be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, to equip the saints for the work of the ministry, for building up the body of Christ, until all of us come to the unity of faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to maturity, to the measure of the full stature of Christ. We must no longer be children, tossed to and fro and blown about by every wind of doctrine, by people's trickery, by their craftiness and deceitful scheming. But speaking the truth in love, we must grow up in every way into him who is the head. said to Jesus, from whom the whole body joined and knit together by every ligament with which it is equipped, as each part is working properly, promotes the body's growth and building itself up in love.
Thank you. Just continue to let that text kind of percolate in you. My last name is Coffee, so I get to say percolate as a metaphor. And we're going to come back to that. So today is, again, we're doing what I'm calling white people's work. We're going to look more at Ephesians, and we're going to talk about the church a bit. Although, again, Anna did a much deeper exploration of the role of the church in issues of racism.
W.E.B. Du Bois, who was one of the early great thinkers of liberation and was very instrumental in establishing the Niagara Movement and the early formation of the NAACP, termed, developed a concept around the term double consciousness. And in that, he shared that there is a lens in which African Americans have to look at the world in terms of through their own blackness, but also have to understand the world through the other identities of the people in power, the majority, particularly white people at the time. And so for me, I'm just not just a pastor. I have to understand what it means to be a black pastor, right? With an African-American context, but also in other contexts. I'm not just at work, the city manager, I'm the black city manager. There's a duality that I have to understand both how to navigate whatever I am doing through the identity of blackness, but also to the expectations of what the people in power, if you will, how they might see me. And so that there's this duality, this double consciousness, that I always have to be aware of my internal filters as an African American, but also aware of things outside of my culture. And that double consciousness does not often exist, if you will, for other people, particularly white people, I want to talk about.
Yes, yeah, so that's maybe a great way to talk about what white people's work might entail. Getting to the point of being able to live with a double consciousness that is not our norm, but something we're willing to take on. So I want to go through a few points about why I'm calling it white people's work. Because the work to be done around racism is uniquely a white people's problem. It is not an equivalency. And I think a lot of times over the years as we've talked about racism, it's like, well, white people got to figure out how to like black people, and black people have to figure out how to like white people, and then we will solve racism. But that's not what racism is, as we'll get to in a few minutes. This is uniquely a white people's problem, so there's uniquely white people's work to do, and we're going to have to own that and let go of thinking that we're all just on the same playing field and that racism is all a mutual problem we've got to deal with. We're coming at it from very different places. And we have to do this hard work together and not expect persons of color to do it for us. It's a conversation white people have to have with each other. I'm going to say more about that, but we have to not expect that some persons of color are going to come in and tell us how to solve racism. And while we do this hard work together, however, we invite persons of color to help us. It would be a little too much to be an isolated group of white folks talking about racism and not listening. So persons of color are, we want to invite and hopefully get a willingness to help us, to listen in on what we're doing, to keep us honest, to tell their stories when they choose to. to expose false assumptions that we might not be aware of in our own inner conversation, and hopefully to support and encourage us in doing that work. I think particularly in the church, we would hope that we would have our brothers and sisters in Christ who are persons of color doing all these things with us. We can't assume that they're going to be excited about doing that. But we can invite and hopefully get a sense of enough safety in the conversation to do that. I've had this thought recently about, in listening to a lot of things going on in the issues around racism, is that, is there any good reason to assume that black folks should trust white people? Is there any good reason to assume that there's trust there, especially as we go into this issue? There isn't, and yet, I've experienced the gift of trust in Mark, in the AME church, in other persons of color. Perhaps you have as well. So we really want to honor that we can't assume that trust can be given, but when it is, that that is an incredible gift that we're getting. And we want to honor that as we do this work. So, a starting place to do this. I'm going to show you the cover of the book. Oh, actually, some of this I'm taking from, I have that on the screen later, but this book called Anxious to Talk About It, Helping White Christians Talk Faithfully About Racism. And this is by Carolyn Helsel, who is a professor at Austin Presbyterian Seminary across the street from my church. I actually discovered the book accidentally before I realized it was from the professor across the street. But she's come in and talked with us about some of this. And she does a good job of helping us approach how difficult it is in the church or elsewhere to talk about this. And so the kind of the dual role of the word anxious in the title, anxious to talk about it, some of us are anxious to talk about it in the sense that we really want to see it happen. And a lot of us are anxious about it because it's incredibly difficult to do. So she does a good job. Here are a few of a lot of this is not necessarily coming from her work, some of it's coming from me, so I'm not going to attribute all this to her. But one, just accept that this is hard to talk about as white folks. It's a lot of feelings that come up, a lot of experiences of trying to talk about it and ending up kind of putting up our hands and walking away from it. It's very hard to do this. And we just have to accept that it's hard to talk about this as white folks. And as we do that, I want to put up a couple things that might be helpful in a setting of conversation. And one is, as we do this, we don't have to be defensive, and we don't have to try to impress one another. Okay. I don't know if you've ever been in circles of conversation where it's just really important for some of us white folks to prove to you that I'm woke and you don't get it. Does that help the conversation anywhere? No, it's about me wanting to signal that I'm virtuous. There's a lot of virtue signaling going on right now in the culture, especially among more progressive folks and in the church. You see it a lot online. You see it in conversations. We don't need to do that. I don't need to prove anything to you that I'm the most woke white guy or that I'm pretty clueless. We just need to have the conversation together and be open around that. And again, defensiveness really doesn't help the conversation. If we're talking about the realities of, say, white privilege, and it quickly makes us want to say be defensive, like, well, I don't take advantage of my white privilege. It doesn't give room to learn this. So neither defensiveness nor trying to impress. And with that, really being careful about how we attack or shame persons as we have the conversation. Another thing right now in our culture is what is called call-out culture. We're very quick to call people out before you've really had any personal encounter with trying to understand why they're saying what they're saying. People often say things that come across in a way that's offensive or ill-informed. We need to think about how we talk about this without simply shaming people or guilting people and shutting it down. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of call-out culture is just shutting down conversation. But I'll come back to that in a second. And again, as Anna did a good job of introducing, there's no need to dwell on guilt. White guilt is not helpful to addressing racism. In fact, I think it's just another insidious way we turn the conversation back around ourselves, which we like to do. Guilt is focusing on us. It gets in the way of this openness that I'm trying to say we need to have the conversation. So we need to get away from guilt. If it's there, we need to kind of just understand why it's not helpful and don't focus on it. We'll get to what the other way of going at how white folks have to address racism is. So the difficulty then is, how do we hold these things in tension in conversation? No silent acceptance of racism among us, but not shaming of persons as they seek to learn and grow and make mistakes. Holding these two things in tension is how I think we can have an actual difficult white people's conversation about racism. We don't just tacitly accept it when it's being voiced or is implicit, but we also don't then let simply the shaming of persons who are expressing kind of white culture, white racism, be the way to deal with it. So I don't have the easy answer to that, but I think if we're mindful of this, we might be able to approach this in a way that's more productive than it often is. So I think being in church, and because I'm Lutheran, I can say this because we have to talk about grace. Being a community of radical grace, that is open to seeing and confessing our wounds and our faults, confessing our racism, and being open to loving our neighbor in new and life-giving ways, whether it's our white neighbor who's wrestling with this, or our black or brown neighbor who we are seeking to improve how we understand the racial realities of our culture. So I think if we really believe in living as a community of grace, we have an open space where the conversation should be able to happen. But we have to name all this, I think, to do that. Any responses to any of this? Does this feel helpful? Does it help a little bit of a breath kind of come out and say, let's not play the games that are being played in this or that place. Let's come together and have the conversation. Okay, so thank you. We have a bunch of quotes we want to share throughout. James Baldwin, I think, is one of the great prophets of the 20th century. And if you can hear this quote, to be a Negro in this country and to be relatively conscious is to be in a rage almost all the time. I think if white people can try to get inside what that is about, not that we can ever experience it as white folks, but to appreciate what this is, might help us go a long way towards understanding how deep the issue is and how difficult it is. Did you have any thoughts about the Baldwin quote, Mark?
No, I think the double consciousness that I mentioned earlier about having to have this dual identity is partly helpful in understanding other cultures, particularly black culture, if you understand how many times we are not able to be as expressive as we want to be without being viewed as being an angry black man or angry black woman. And what we're trying to do is to express the frustrations or feelings that we have about how we feel or don't, or are not being heard. And I think, you know, there are a lot of things. And I have to be delicate. We were having there's just one conversation that just sets me off every time. And it's not about the historical slavery. I had a trigger moment yesterday. It's not about the historical slavery. It's about the biblical slavery. And it's about not what happened in Egypt when we were liberated, but it's about the biblical narrative that continues to encourage slaves to obey their masters or to help Philemon. It is that kind of narrative, and it triggers me in a way that brings about an anger, but it doesn't do it at the same time for other people, and feels like, you know, people begin to white-splain it, Like, it's okay. It's okay. I'm not saying Michael.
Of course not. This is very actually an important point. Mark and I have had this conversation for the last couple of years about biblical texts and slavery. And I'm not trying to dismiss or apologize for those texts, but we're having a very different reaction to those texts and how we try to deal with them. And that needs to be honored, that they're heard very differently and have a very different response to them. And I certainly do honor that. So speaking of responses, yes, I'm sorry. No? Okay. I'm going to show you some words on the screen, one by one, with a few seconds in between, and I want you to think about how you respond to these words or phrases, okay? Who can say which of these you have the most negative response to? Or which two? Is that your hand or the pen?
Yes. White culture.
White culture. Okay.
Yes.
White power.
Benjamin?
Yeah, white power.
White power? Okay.
I'd say both white power and black power.
Okay. Pardon me?
The names.
The names. When Michael Brown was killed, do you remember your response to that incident? How did you interpret that? Did you interpret it the same way that you were hearing black folks interpret that? When Black Lives Matter became a thing, do you remember your initial response to that saying? And did you feel the need to say all lives matter because you felt left out? When you hear about black power, you know, there was the black power movement in the 60s and 70s, that stirred up a lot of anxiety and fear for a lot of white folks.
Scary.
Scary to think about black people with power. It's important to, I think, two things to think about with this is, one, how your response just comes to some of these things, your initial lens of interpretation, and also how it's probably very different from how persons of color interpret the very same things. If you're white, you may have one response. If you're not white, you may have another. Maybe not, but you're coming at it from probably very different lenses. And why is one positive or negative or unclear for you is worth pondering. This one, the last one, I think is quite interesting in this moment because it wasn't until, I think, recently that in the popular culture there was a positive conversation happening about reparations. If it was brought up. So the discussion of reparations became more of a national issue after the article by Ta-Nehisi Coates was published about 4 or 5 years ago in The Atlantic, where he just kind of went through the whole case for it. I think it's called Case for Reparations. Many people dismissed it and said, this is silly. This, how could this work? This, why would we do that? In this moment, right, we're in right now, it's actually become something that people are having a more positive response to the conversation. May not know what it means or looks like or how it happens. But for gosh sakes, when David Brooks writes a column in the New York Times saying, I now think reparations are an important topic to pursue, I thought something's happening in a culture. But mostly the response is quite negative in white communities.
White culture, how would you define that?
Hmm. Yeah.
What does that even mean?
Well, I'm not defining these terms so much as trying to see what they elicit in you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to do it.
You'll pay for that one tonight.
I'm going to do what Anna's not doing until later in the week.
Tomorrow.
Which is, tomorrow, thank you. We're going to talk about what do we mean when we say racism. We may be coming at it with very different definitions. Maybe you've done some of this work before and you've had some clarity on this. So we need to have some definitions. Because I said earlier that as we talk about this, this is not an equivalency between black and white or white and persons of color. Why is that? Well, the most standard operating definition for racism is prejudice plus power. So we might say everyone has prejudices towards other groups of people. That you evaluate and make assumptions about other people based on certain categories that you perceive they belong to. That's probably true. I think we might maybe experience people have prejudices about white people, okay? But racism is something far beyond that. It is to have the power to enforce your prejudices through law, through institutions, through social power, social constructs. So that's why we have to talk about racism as something that, that's one reason why we have to talk about racism as a uniquely white issue to address, because in our world, white people have the power. And that's still true, even though our society is changing. It is also something that is systemic. It is about systems of power, institutions, government. It is not simply about our individual beliefs, our thoughts and feelings and attitudes and prejudice towards others. So I may be a white person who kind of figured out I've had all these prejudices and I've kind of addressed them, so I'm not part of this problem anymore. But it's not about you as an individual. It's about how you are part of a much bigger system of power that may benefit you and may harm others, and makes it much more complex to deal with. In fact, this can get overwhelming pretty quickly, but this is where we have to go. So again, racism is not an equivalency on both sides because of this power differential and because of historical reality. We're talking about historical things here, not just generic concepts. I like to say that white supremacy invented the concept of race, and racism is how that is sustained. Race is not a given thing in how we think about humanity. It is an invented concept in order to invent the concept of whiteness and who is not white. And that all comes from white supremacy. So they're all interconnected. But I had this little new theory that I'm operating out of, that perhaps instead of talking about racism, we should really talk more specifically about white supremacy. Because racism can sound like that generic thing that isn't specific enough. Or maybe we have to talk about white racism and not just racism. So I'm just holding that for myself as maybe a way to keep thinking about, we always have to say it's a very specific thing, not a general thing. Questions or thoughts about trying to define racism? Yes?
It is interesting to me to just acknowledge what happened in my body when you said that last thing.
Okay.
I'm willing to admit I'm part of racism. Am I willing to admit I'm part of white supremacy?
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah.
You know, it's a gut thing.
Yeah, and often when we hear the phrase white supremacy, yeah, we think about white supremacists, you know, Charlottesville, people marching with tiki torches, or people living, you know, somewhere out in the hills out in the west who have their enclaves. But you might stop and think then when it's said about how do you evaluate black culture. It's very common for white folks to sort of implicitly feel that white culture is superior to black culture. Or other ways we are evaluating things, it is a supremacy mentality that is very deep, and it's not simply about extremism.
I would also add that prejudice plus the misuse of power.
Uh-huh.
Because power by itself can be good or bad. But I think of racism as prejudice with the misuse of power to privilege some and oppress others.
I agree with that. I might be a little more cynical and think anytime people have power over others, prejudice is there, so it's going to be misused. Yeah, but I agree with you. Power does have a positive component that we need to explore how we use our power.
Yeah, there was an interesting
discussion
here last year in a race-related session where someone talked about their white friend who went to Detroit to apply for a contract, you know, to take on, he was competing for a contract to do something there. And the Detroit political structure is mainly black, and the guy who was talking to him said blatantly, well, you're not going to get it for one reason, you're white. And so earlier in that session, we had defined racism as, you know, prejudice plus power and used in a way so that you're hurting someone else. Right. And in a way, so it was interesting because then people said right away, well, that's not racism because it was a black person doing it. But according to the definition they had put there, it was racism. And I really struggled with it, and I finally came up with, yes, it is racism, but it's appropriate racism. And I think the last thing they're talking about, using the term white supremacy instead, in that context, you understand that it's appropriate to make that decision based on race. You know?
Yeah,
so I like that white supremacy thing. That kind of lays it right out there.
Okay, good. Mark, you have a response.
Yeah, and I want to comment on the issue you mentioned. What clearly is discrimination. So when you treat people differently because of their race, regardless of what race it is, that's you're discriminating against that person. So what happened in that contractor situation, that's exactly, because they were white, they were treated differently. And what we want is an inclusive society where everyone is treated based on merit, based on ability. I think apart from that, what we're talking about under white supremacy is racism. We're treating one group differently because we believe we are superior in intellect, we're superior in, or they are inferior. And we're not, in the instance you mentioned, and there may be other nuances, but if we're talking about to affirmatively do things to be more proactive in trying to create opportunities, and because of that, there may be more affirmative reasons to hire minorities or black contractors. And yes, in that instance, yep, some people who are not in that underrepresented group are treated differently, discriminated against, if you will, but it is not with the intent of believing that one group is inferior or superior than the other.
I saw a hand back here, I wanted to make sure.
Two quick things. The first one, white supremacy makes me think about the whole, if only they would assimilate conversation.
Yeah, we're gonna get to some
and
of that
so,
too.
Okay, good, I'm glad you're going to get to because you hear that all the time, well, they only act like us, we like them.
Which is completely white supremacy and racist.
Totally,
right?
And I didn't make that connection until just now, so thank you for that. And the second one is that we currently have people gathering the signatures for Initiative 88 in Washington State, because the legislature made some decisions based on affirmative action and how we include people. And there are now a whole lot of people out there calling this reverse discrimination.
Right. Or reverse racism, sometimes people call it that.
Yeah, so and, just two things to put on the table and you can do what you want with them.
Yeah. There's so much that we could dive into. Let me take two more hands, and then we're going to need to...
Could you do a quick summary of white supremacy invented the concept of race and racism? Because that's something a lot of people, I think, don't...
Yeah, this is my way of trying to get at, one, the lie behind all of this is white supremacy. And so in order to sustain white supremacy, you have to then develop ways of keeping other people who aren't white down. Because otherwise, you're going to start to see that white folks aren't all that all the time. So you have to have distinct races once you identify people as white. Basically, there's no difference between identifying people as white and identifying people as supreme. The two concepts exist for the same purpose. So then you have to have racism in order to... racism is just the natural extension of that. Now, you might turn it around and say that one created the other. I'm just trying to bring a different spin to how we think about these things.
I was going to say, the term white supremacy, in my mind, invites moving past the sort of kind of racism around contractors or those kinds of decisions, and gets me to thinking about, so why is it schools are funded by property taxes?
Why are schools funded by property taxes?
To the point you raised in the last session, why is it, you know, some denominations have a retreat center or a lovely park, and others would not have that? Or, you know, what are all the trappings of power that I have access to? And I would not have thought of it but for switching the terminology away from racism.
Wonderful. For the next slide, I just want to say, as we learned yesterday at Anna's presentation, she had a quote from Toni Morrison, who just died. Was it yesterday or the day before?
The fifth.
Mark had pre-chosen a quote from Toni Morrison. I'm going to let him to...
we're talking about, do we really want to use the entire quote? We have to not spill out the full word here. But there's just some things we have to get rid of. And her quote was so eloquent. I said, what if I haven't got to get rid of all of the stuff?
I don't think that's what that stands for.
That weighs us down. And this notion of supremacy, just as in the same case of gender, I mean, there is no superior gender. And we know that it's a power issue. It's a male power issue. And it's the same thing with race. There's no superior race. And we got to get rid of that stuff. Otherwise, it will weigh us down individually, it will weigh us down as a country, it will weigh us down as a community, it will weigh us down as a church. And so we talked about this quote, and we had no idea she had passed away, or she had not passed away.
Right. I think you're going to help us think about this issue.
And some of us may be, you know, well-intended and say that we have no white supremacist, not white supremacist bone in our bodies. And that may be the very intent, but the impact of some of the things that we have been socialized to may cause some to do some things unconsciously or based on tradition. You may have some implicit bias in how you see others and yourself.
And you've done work in cities and things with trying to get at implicit bias. There are inventories, there are ways to work at it, because it's actually quite difficult to uncover it. So there are tools and ways to get at it.
It's hard work because people have to go into their own personal histories and personal stories and how they were raised and how they were brought up. And sometimes identify things that, there's some things I wouldn't want to share around my upbringing and how my parents raised me. That's embarrassing to a lot of people because you always want to honor your father and your mother. But there are some things that are in us, and sometimes it's through exposure to our own faith traditions that causes to have this implicit bias.
Okay, so we interrupt this presentation with a poem. How many of you have wrestled with family history as white folks, because that's what we're going to talk about for a second only, and how racism has been evident in your own family history? You wrestle with that? Okay. So this became apparent to me recently. I was thinking about this and some different news events and different things going on in us. So I wrote this. I'm going to share it with you and see how what it resonates for you. This whiteness. Grandfather could so smoothly pour his evening whiskey and slur an N-word or five during Lawrence Welk before the gentle nod off in his 1950s recliner green. Aunt would teach school children and love them so, she said, even the little black ones, she said, and still speak of them diminutively and of their parents dismissively, and end the day with a refreshing front porch lemonade. Some ancestor in Massachusetts fought for abolition and justice and spoke of prophets Amos and Jesus, but never imagined in her white mind wrapped in razor wire a fullness in blackness, a greatness, a she and he empowered, a liberation of herself from her white self. And here I am, attentive, but in white fog, of my own insolence and actions, my crossing the streets of Chicago when young black men approach, when I see the protests and riots and think, if you would just, if you could only, when I make every effort for my white sons, and even writing this poem, and even writing that previous line, cannot end it, this whiteness, this inherited shame and shamelessness, this enfolding in my brain of what we ourselves, by our fault, by our own fault, by our own most grievous fault, have wrought, have clung to white-knuckled, have ignored in our beloveds, have so blithely pruned from family trees, and cannot prune from ourselves.
Who wrote that?
Me.
Oh. Wow.
I was trying to process some things as I work on these issues and realize we all got to deal with some family history. We got to deal with what's come to us and how it's in us, and there's a lot of shame. And so a lot of it we just write out of our stories. Any other resonance for anyone that you would just briefly want to comment on? I see a hand I haven't called on before, yes.
The line of liberation of herself from her white self is really interesting to me because I'm not a type of person who, when I wake up in the morning, I have to remember that I'm in a white body. And I know that there are people across the world who wake up and have to consciously remember, like you said about double consciousness, that I am in a X body so that I can operate a certain way so that I don't get shot or arrested or whatever it might be, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I don't, it's really interesting for me to think about what sort of liberation I might need myself from myself. Mm-hmm. Because I'm so unaware of my whiteness in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that. You know, one of the things I haven't put in the presentation today, which I've been trying to say more often, is white people need to be liberated from racism. It is dehumanizing to white people to be racist, to treat other people as less. And we need to, you know, not that we're, again, the primary issue, but we need our own liberation from this and then try to express it. Oh, one more comment.
Yeah, two things. One, can you have a copy of this?
It's on my blog.
It's on your blog.
Okotiopub.org. I'll share it with you next time. But okotiopub.org. I posted it on my blog about
Martin's. Okay, I love that poem. And like the first couple things also, I mean, I think that is an example of why white culture gave me such a negative reaction because it's so unconscious. Mm-hmm. I mean, white supremacists, you can see it. And there are actually FBI people and stuff infiltrating, trying to do something about it. But the whole rest of the culture is just insidious and hidden, you know, just like that stuff. And so that makes it scarier.
Yes. Okay. Another we talked about implicit bias. It's an important concept to work on. Another very important concept to work on is white privilege. I don't know how you thought about this, if you think this is a reality or not. But it is. And before I ask for responses for the question, I've been thinking about this since I got here. I've commented in a couple conversations when my wife Catherine and I were here 2 years ago, absolutely love this place, we're back, wanted to be here. But it came very apparent to us this place is very white. That's for all kinds of reasons. But what occurred to me this time is, if you know the story of how Holden Village came to be, you know, it was a copper mine, some other ores they were mining, in the 30s to the 50s. And then the mine shut down. And then they tried to sell it for $100,000. They didn't get any takers for a while. And then some Lutheran guy connected to the Lutheran Church in Washington wrote a letter basically saying, I'd like you to give this to the Lutherans so we could create a retreat center. And it took a while and some persistence, and then connections were made, and it happened. I want you to ask yourself, if that had been an AME pastor and a group of black folks saying, we'd like you to give us a property so we could have a black church camp. Would that have ever happened? It would never have happened, right? That's some pretty powerful white privilege right there. This place only exists as we know it because of white privilege. Again, that's not something to be feel, still, oh, we need to feel guilty about a whole village. We need to know that so that we are working I like to call it dismantling privilege or deprivileging whiteness in our lives. But so the question then is, how has white privilege impacted your life? Because whether you're white or a person of color, it has. Does anybody have any thoughts? Just an example or something that you can share?
I worked in the construction industry most of my life.
I'm going to just repeat a few things so everybody hears. You worked in construction industry.
Construction industry, and because I owned my own business, I was just myself. I didn't have any employees. But there were privileges that I could have gotten by declaring that I was a white woman, a white business owner.
Okay.
That gave me, could have given me privileges into the bidding process for jobs and stuff.
Right.
And at the same time, it was the white women-owned business, and it was the minority business owner. So I was kind of lumped in with.
Okay.
I mean, I was part of that terminology, and I always felt like, wait a minute, I don't want to be lumped into any group. I want to be able to just do, and that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I was kind of not that I just didn't want to be singled out. It helped a lot of people get contracts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good. But I thought, why are we putting women in with? Why?
Okay, so there, as we say this, there are different kinds of privilege that exists.
Yeah.
There's male privilege, there's white privilege, there's hetero privilege. There's all kinds of things in our culture where certain people are just given advantage without it even being conscious.
Yeah.
So, so there's one. Other reactions or thoughts about how has white privilege impacted your life? Yes.
I live in South Minneapolis, so really diverse neighborhood, and there's a corner grocery store that has a sign that says no backpacks allowed. Mm-hmm. And I was going there with my backpack intending to fill it, but I offered it to the person at the cash register as they passed on the sign, and they said, no, you're okay.
Yeah. Wow. I remember growing up, like, going to the bowling alley, and they had all these no loitering signs. I did not realize till recently those were actually ways to quickly discriminate against groups of persons of color. So you could tell them they couldn't just hang out around there. But they never did that to the white kids. Other experiences of white privilege, whether you're a person of color or not? Yes.
I worked on the Navajo reservation for some time, and since then become so aware of what we white people did to our Native Americans. And it's not black, but it's the same thing. And we have put them in groups, you stay there.
Yeah, right. Let me take one person I haven't called on before, I believe. Yes, back here? Yes.
When I was growing up, 3 times my family moved, and my parents sought out places to live in the suburbs where their 2 kids could get what they considered to be the best education. And that landed us in 3 predominantly white suburbs each time. I could spend days trying to enumerate how many different privileges gave me, and growing up in predominantly white communities with predominantly white teachers and predominantly white schools, who knows how many crazy ways I've benefited from that kind of segregation and that kind of privilege.
Yeah, and so I think we have to keep having the conversation and naming it because it's operative all around us all the time. And if persons of color tell us their experiences and they're trying to name that white privilege is operative, it's not always easy to hear that. It's not always easy to take that at face value. And I think we have to work on that. One thing we struggle with is, you know, like white people today, like, well, we weren't around when there was slavery, and we didn't create Jim Crow, and all these things. And there's a tendency to say that, well, we're not responsible for this, so why do we have to deal with this? Why can't we just be good white people instead of anti-racist white people? So one thing to keep in mind is, we might not be responsible for it, but we have a response to it. We must have a response to it. We have the ability to respond to this thing. And I use this analogy that I thought about recently. Let's say you had some land that your ancestors had owned. We could say this for Old Village, right? So we Lutherans inherited this land, but the land was leaching toxins into the water, and that is affecting other people. So it's not Holden Village's fault that's what the land was that, you know, we got. It's nothing to feel guilty about, but not to address it is to then just be complicit in the poisoning of releasing toxins into the world. So a response is required. To me, that's a helpful metaphor, because you might think about inheriting white privilege, white supremacy, racism as toxin that is continuing to leach out in the world. And we do have the ability to respond to that. And if we use the terminology here, to remediate, and even go beyond remediation, but to restore, to do the things that will bring it, you know, lives back to what they could and should be. That's the kind of work. So, you know, we have to let go of this idea that that just because we didn't cause it, that we don't have a response. Yes, Alex. Okay, so you are an adult in a home where it's run by first generation from Nepal, and they speak Nepalese when communicating with each other, even when I am around. So the result of that makes you feel excluded? Don't quite understand the conversion or conversation? The conversation. Yeah, you don't understand what they're saying. Mm. Yeah. And that leaves you out of that place. Mm. Yeah, yeah. That's another good metaphor for thinking about what we're doing. So here's our text again.
Let's go back to that, because I hear that a lot too around Spanish speaking and bilingual and whether or not by being inclusive of other culture and language, does that exclude other people? Mm-hmm. Like, no, we need to speak English only.
Right.
And so I think the way to be inclusive is to do exactly that, to be bilingual, dual-lingual, trilingual as much as we can. But then to understand there are some times where people do not feel comfortable speaking in the predominant language by either skill, ability, or whatever. They may want to speak in Swahili, Vietnamese, whatever the language is, and you just have to be, at times, be comfortable or create cultural competency and attempt to learn their language, mm-hmm. like they're attempting to learn our language. Mm-hmm.
Just, I think Beverly Tatum's book is really helpful here. On, it's a foundational book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And the idea, mm-hmm. you know, that mm-hmm. sometimes people need their space, mm-hmm.
And it's not about so much excluding others as just we need some time and space. So it's a really helpful book. But I also have just been thinking about how many of us have had congregations where we've had, like, let's meet a church of another denomination that's predominantly of another race than us, had a social, had a potluck, had, or let's celebrate diversity, or let's use more hymns from other people. Have we done these kinds of things?
Right.
I'm just struck by how much richer white church efforts of that kind of thing would be if we were doing this alongside or before, instead of just, oh, let's be together and celebrate diversity. This is a whole nother level that churches could.
Yeah, so that's the point, that we're talking about this interracial fellowship between congregations, that doesn't really happen well if white people don't do their work. That's the point.
Right.
Here's our text. I want to point out a couple things about this text. One, to go back to the verse from yesterday about unity. Unity can be oppression. Talking about unity can be oppression. So we need to be careful about this. White people seeking unity can be oppression because of what we said earlier. It can mean we expect you to conform to being white, and then we can all be one. To assimilate, right. That's a problem that we have to be mindful of. Unity can be a means of silencing dissent and forcing conformity. You know, if you're the one raising your voice, if you're the one that's angry, you're the problem with unity, right? When in fact, that's the voice that needs to be heard to get to unity. So we have to be careful about silencing. And it can't be achieved without addressing the root causes of the division in the first place. Therefore, there is no feel-good way to address racism. There's no feel-good way. Only the hard, painful, humbling work that white people must do can lead toward unity. And I think we often, especially in the church, we kind of want to jump to the kumbaya moment and get there quickly. And it's not gonna work. Alex, I saw your hand again. They instruct each other in Nepalese. Nepalese. Okay. When a new person's on staff, they teach each other how to communicate that way and still sort of being very intentional about leaving out. So they're communicating with each other about how to provide care for the residents in the house. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
And so, again, that feels like they should be saying it in a way that you understand what they're saying. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Sounds like there's some work to do there.
Nothing about me without me.
Say again?
Nothing about me without
me. Nothing about me without me. Right. Yes. And you're a...
Particularly if they're speaking about Alex, they should be inclusive.
Yes. So here's the hard part to get to now. How do we speak the truth in love? Well, that's the verse that we're focusing on. When have you had the opportunity to speak the truth in love? And specifically, we're thinking about issues of racism and whiteness. And did you do it, or did you fail to do it? How have you responded when someone spoke the truth in love to you? And is your church a place where racism can actually be discussed? We want to focus on this a little bit, but to do that, we're also going to let Mark share.
I'm being mindful of the time.
Yeah.
There are a couple times where I thought people could have helped and give voice to an issue where I didn't have to be the only person speaking up. And in my life, I've been around people who use the N-word, both in culture and out of culture. I've been called the N-word. And I've had several responses. Number one, I had my own personal response where I'm just not gonna let anybody get away with that and address it. So we talk about the term call out, and I wanna talk about speaking up now, same term. But I had white people come afterwards and say, the first response, well, you know Jim, he's just like that. He's old, he grew up in another era. He didn't mean any harm. Translation, he's an old racist. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Right.
That's what we're really talking about. And so are we gonna continue to not hold Jim accountable for not only what he's saying, but the effect that he's having on other people? Or the other response, I'm so sorry. That was so inappropriate. In private.
Right.
Give me empathy in private. Okay, so now, what are you going to do to make sure that that person doesn't speak like that in your presence again? Because apparently the thought it was okay with you around. And if you just make these private apologies, you continue to condone that kind of public kind of behavior, because they might hear it better from you than they would come in from me. And so I think we want to have that opportunity to speak and call out some things that would otherwise give people license to continue to act up way over and over.
So here's what we're going to do with the rest of our time. We're going to invite you to have a conversation with people around you as you see fit around these questions. When you've had these experiences, similar to what Mark said or others, or maybe it's just all white people, and how have you struggled with trying to speak the truth in love? And then we're going to come back and process that a little bit, and then we're going to send you off with a few suggestions and some difficult questions to wrestle with after this meeting. Okay, so let's take about 5 minutes or so. Discuss these people with some folks around you. I'm going to let you decide who that should be, and I'll call you back.
I have one that I didn't actually realize after how I could have handled this. This was a poor decision. So I worked with a lot of church groups. We were with a church group and a designer. Get to my office and me and my boss.
Working with them, and I just,
I just shut them in. So they were.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt. I know you got lots of good stories going on, but I'm going to ask you to, so we can do a couple more things before we need to get to lunch, and I do appreciate you staying a little longer. I'm going to ask you to hold those conversations in your hearts and amongst each other. We're going to do some more processing of all this at the beginning of Friday, so kind of hold on to some of that. On the last one, I just want to just say out loud, imagine that our churches were places that were courageous enough to have these conversations. Maybe they already are, maybe they're trying to get there. But I think that's where I'd like to see us get. So some ways to try to deal with things. So this is Mike the White Guy's top suggestions. So, I'm not an expert in anti-racism. I'm not, that much farther along or further behind than anybody else. I've just been trying to work on this. And these are the things that have been meaningful for me and helpful, and they may be to you. The first one is absolutely the most important one for me. When black people tell you their stories, believe them. Let that be your default stance. When you hear stories about discrimination, racism, about police, about all these experiences, when you hear those stories, just believe them. Because often our white response is, oh, there must be more to the story. Or they must have done something that, created that. Or we start blaming persons of color, or black persons, for their own experiences of racism. When they tell you the stories, first of all, feel honored that they told you their stories. Yeah. It's not often that a lot of folks, persons of color, feel safe telling their stories to white people. Why? Because they constantly get rejection. Like, oh, that can't be true. You must have. Feel honored you got to hear their story, and then believe them. Speak the truth in love among white folks, especially when it's hard. That's what we're trying to work on here. Do not turn anti-racism into a conversation about white versus black. We kind of like, well, white people are trying to get their thing, whatever. It's really about justice versus injustice. And so it's not like I'm on the white side, but are we on the side for being a part of seeking justice in our world? I think that's a helpful framework. listen, and then listen again, and then listen, and maybe a little later after listening some more, speak a little, or not, you don't have to. So we have a lot of listening to do, is what I'm trying to say. And we often are very quick to try to interject with white-splaining, or trying to, you know, those other things we talk about, trying to prove ourselves, trying to do all kinds of things as white people out of our guilt or our superiority or whatever it is. What if we just listen a lot more?
But you're not saying stay silent.
No, I'm not saying that. But before we get to the point in conversations with persons of color, we have a lot more listening to do than speaking. Yeah. Embrace Black culture. And emphasize the positive and greatness in it. I can say this about any other minority culture. We've been focusing on a lot of issues of white and black. I find that the concept of black culture is often negatively evaluated in white communities. I encourage us to find ways that we can embrace black culture for what it is, emphasize what is great about it, because it's a pretty phenomenal set of cultural realities that is black culture. And if you don't understand it, keep listening and learning about it. You cannot live in a colorblind world. I think we've all figured that out by now. But every person you meet may live out of their identity differently. So let go of assumptions with each person you meet and let them tell you who they are. Don't tell them who they are. How often are white people trying to tell black people who they are because they're black? You know, we assume that their experience must be this or that. One common thing I've, you know, wrestled with myself is you may not realize that a particular individual you meet, you may assume that they're of one political belief system and they're actually of a different one. And so this, we can't deny that we have these different racial realities that are rooted in racism, but at the same time, every individual person you meet is an individual person. And stop projecting on who you think they must be. Those are support black institutions and organizations directly and indirectly. Because a lot of this is already being addressed robustly in the black community through the necessary creation of black institutions and organizations over the last two centuries. The more we can support the work they're doing, the more there's going to be a lot done. It's not necessarily our work to do all that, it's to support it. And I encourage you to find ways to do that. And expect to be humbled, surprised, to make mistakes, and to learn more as we go along. The work will never be done, and we have to continue to just be on the journey. I want to mention three books that I've been using recently. The most significant one for me is the first one, White Rage. This is incredibly powerful and difficult reading about, from Reconstruction on, the way the white reaction to black advancement or black empowerment is rage and violence and terror and evil, I would have to say. It is the history we don't learn in our history books. How many of you are familiar with the Tulsa race riots in 1921? How many people learned that when you were growing up? None of us. One of the most significant events in American history. We never learned the most destructive event of racism probably since Reconstruction, and we never learned a thing about it. Up to 300 people were killed, 300 black persons were killed, up to 10,000 were homeless. An entire black community was destroyed. The wealthiest black community in the United States was destroyed out of white rage.
What year was that?
1921. So White Rage, I highly recommend it. White Fragility, you probably heard about already. Anna's talked about that. It's become a pretty well-known book. Why it's so hard for white people to talk about it. And then Anxious to Talk About It, I mentioned, specifically in the church, yes, the white church. You may know this quote from King, but it's worth hearing again today. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. I'm going to just quickly show you this. I'm going to skip the rest. I have two of my own books in the bookstore, so this is my shameless plug. But this book in particular, I have a chapter in there that I was going to read part of it, I'm not, on Hey White Church and thinking about the importance of the white church, both in creation of and sustaining of racism and addressing it. So I recommend that to you because I wrote it. And the foreword is by Mark Washington. The foreword of the book is by Mark Washington. And I will say I would not have ended up publishing it without Mark's encouragement and support, because I was a little scared to publish that book. This is my other book. It's in the bookstore. It's poetry. Go for it. We're going to end with a quote from James Baldwin and then some questions for you to walk away with. We can disagree and still love each other unless your disagreement is rooted in my oppression and denial of my humanity and right to exist. So when we talk about certain conversations, there's certain conversations we're just not going to have. We're not going to argue whether white people are superior to black people. We're not going to argue about whether people have a right to exist based on gender identity or sexuality. We're not going to have those conversations because they assume there's a valid argument there to discuss. So don't, you know, we're not going to play into that game. There's a ground level that we need to be at, and that is affirming people for who they are. And then we talk about, we can disagree about things after that. I'm going to quickly go to the questions I need to send you off with. These are ones, I want you to wrestle with these and to come back next time or whatever. Are you more concerned about offending white people than you are about defending persons of color? Are you more worried about preserving your status among white neighbors than you are about seeking justice for your non-white neighbors? Are you more attuned to white sensitivities than you are to black lives? Are you more willing to speak a lie in love than you are to speak the truth in love? We're going to end there. And next time we'll pick up and process some more, and then we're going to go into what do we do in the church. All right. Thank you.